All right, so where do I start? Let's just kind of go to the laundry list, okay, for why we think this is a zero and why we think it's way short. Number one, it's vastly overvalued at 30 times sales. Number two, the financials are a dumpster fire. Next, insider selling. So if you wanted any corroboration, all you have to do is, look at the filings. Deteriorating quality of revenue. The machine is barely used if you just look at their recurring revenue kind of on a per install basis. Let's just use some common sense. If what they're saying is true, why have they only placed 92 machines in 5 years?
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Zero's TV in the Chopping Block. I'm joined today by Kier Kalan of Scorpion Capital. Kier, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me back, Max. Great to see you.
All right. So, who's on the Chopping Block?
It's a company called Berkeley Lights. The ticker is BLI. The market cap is about $2.5 billion.
All right. And what do they claim to do?
That's a great question because it's very difficult for people to do what they actually do, reading their filings and going to their website. There's so much jargon and nomenclature and fancy made-up words that it actually takes some time for the typical investor to understand what their product is. Part of the reason why I think it's an interesting short is that I think most people that own it, they would not be able to explain to you what it actually does. It's kind of one of these, story stocks that people own because they think they have something, cool and interesting. But nobody's talked to any customers. Nobody's bothered to understand the value proposition of technology. Once you do that, you understand that it's completely vaporous and there's not much there. So what Berkeley Lights says that they do is something called digital cell biology. What does that mean? Well, it actually means nothing because when you Google it, you realize that the only hits that come up are their website. It's just sort of a term that they created because there is no such thing as a digital cell. They use all these fancy terms that they've, trademarked, nano pens and, deep, opto profiling. But the end of the day, what they sell is basically a glorified flow cytometer. A flow cytometer is it's a very common commodity piece of lab equipment that you'll see in pretty much every lab. You can buy these things on eBay for a few $1,000. They're used. You can buy a new kind of entry level one for 25, 50,000. You can buy a super high end one for maybe $500,000. Compared to Berkeley Lights machine, which is $2 million. So what flow cytometers do is that they help you identify cells. Identifying cells is one of the most basic things that anybody does in biology or medicine in a lab. So a common use case for cell analysis, the term that people use is an assay. An assay is just a term for sort of an analysis or an experiment. Is let's say you have a blood sample, right? Somebody's in chemotherapy or you're trying to develop an antibody. A sample of blood can have thousands of different kinds of cells in it. And so you need to understand, how many red blood cells are there, how many white blood cells are there, how many T cells are there, are there viruses, right? There are thousands of different things that you might want to screen that blood sample for, depending on what your use case, your application is. So you can't really do much biology without being able to count the number of cells in a sample, without being able to characterize those cells. So, 50, 60 years ago, people developed a technology called flow cytometry, where they flow cells past a laser or a few lasers. They stain the cells with fluorescent reagents, essentially dyes. Then as the light from the lasers hits the cells, it scatters it. And then you have sensors that basically analyze that light scattering pattern, count the number of cells to understand the size of the cells and to understand characteristics, the internal characteristics of some of these cells. So flow cytometry has been around for decades and decades. What Berkeley Lights has is essentially a very specialized kind of flow cytometer that gives you somewhat higher resolution, but it's nothing which is particularly revolutionary. So that's the right way to think about what they do. It's essentially a glorified cell cytometer, and the use case is very, very similar to what people have used flow cytometers for decades. And there's a subset of flow cytometry called cell sorting, where you not only characterize the cells, but then you sort them into different containers. So you want to purify the sample so you can take those purified cells and you can go out and run some other sort of assay. This is just a technology that claims to have some bells and whistles. They say that you can actually kind of do this at the single cell level. One issue with flow cytometry is that you may not be able to get a live cell out of the sample because that flowing and that processing can damage a very delicate cell. but it's very, very incremental. You know, it's certainly not enough to be worth, you know, 20 times what a standard flow cytometer sells for. So that's what they do. The right way to think about this is flow cytometry. You can go to Wikipedia, you can understand what flow cytometers are. You can go to eBay, you can look at, you know, what a used flow cytometer costs. This is just kind of like a very fancy version of that.
Okay. And so you mentioned it's over a $2 billion market cap at the time we're recording this, but I've read, you know, the rough draft of your report, and you believe that this company is worth next to nothing. Obviously, there has to be some discrepancy between what they claim to do, or at least what they claim to be the size of the market and what the reality is. So what leads you to believe that this company is a total zero?
There are many layers to it. It's actually unusual to find a short where essentially every single major claim that the company makes, every single aspect of the bull case, just makes no sense. This is a one product company. They have a machine called the Beacon. That's a $2 million product. They've created a dumbed down version of the product that we think sells for $750,000. It's called Lightning. It's basically sold, no units. We think maybe, you know, 7 or 8 units in the first 18 months of launch. So this is a one product company where the product, according to customers that we talk to, and we talk to a very broad sample of their customers, the product just doesn't work. Not only does it not actually operate a lot of the time, right? It can break down for weeks at a time. It can have contamination issues. It can have issues with fluidics, just, you know, day-to-day issues with the hardware. There are all kinds of issues with the software that customers told us about that essentially rendered the machine usable. So aside from it not working, it actually doesn't deliver the value proposition that they say that it does. They say that the machine can be used for primarily two use cases. One is called cell line development. One is called antibody discovery. We don't really need to kind of get into the details of what those use cases are. But they say that you can actually dramatically speed up cell line development. You can speed up antibody discovery. So a process that might take you, you know, 6 to 9 months, they claim that you can complete in days. One customer after another that we talked to, and this is corroborated by former employees that we spoke to, said that's just simply not true, right? That it's not any faster. So you have a company that sells a machine that doesn't work a lot of the time, that doesn't actually do what they purport that it can do. It has really high error rates, right? And this is one recurring theme of, I think, pretty much every single customer interview, is that you can't even trust the output of the data from the machine. Right, so you spend $2 million, and then you don't know if the data, the hits that it's giving you, are correct. So then you have to go and redo all of your assays using your traditional workflows. So you just have double the amount of work. It defeats the entire purpose of it.
And these aren't just like dink and dunk little companies, too. The types of companies that are buying this product, they know what they're doing, and they have experience doing these types of runs. I think it's worth mentioning, you know, that these are massive multi-billion-dollar pharmaceutical companies that are really not happy with this product.
Yeah, so it's a great question, and kind of raises a key point, which is, you know, why do they have any customers at all? Because they have an install base of about 92 machines, which is interesting given that the product was launched in 2016. Right, so for a product which is supposedly this revolutionary, which enables you to, you know, make these dramatic advances in your drug discovery process, why have they only placed 92 machines over essentially 5 years, particularly if your total addressable market is something like $25 billion, right? And nobody else has this technology. That's kind of like the big elephant in the room. What they accomplished in doing is they've created a lot of buzz, right? They have a prominent venture capital firm that's backing them. They have a Nobel Prize winner that's on the board, you know, who's been paid a ridiculous amount of money in cash and stock, you know, lest anybody think that, you know, the presence of a Nobel Prize winner means that this thing is real. But what they did was they created enough buzz that a number of large pharmaceutical companies bought the product. Some of them bought a few. Some of them bought, you know, 5 or 10 just to try it out, right? Because you're an Amgen and you have a $100 billion plus market cap or whatever, or you're Bristol Myers Squibb, all these mega cap pharmaceutical companies, you know, what do you really care, right? If you could go find like some, you know, $10, $20 million potential drug, what do you care if you go out and spend $2 million? Maybe the technology works, maybe it didn't. So they actually amassed a pretty interesting set of these large pharmaceutical companies. We think they're actually in most of the top 30. And we talked to about 13 of them. You know, major companies, Amgen, Bristol-Myers Squibb, you know, we talked to Pfizer, we talked to Novartis, we talked to Takeda. You know, you go down to kind of that list of largest, you know, pharmaceutical biotech companies by market cap, we hit a lot of them in the top 10, top 20, top 30, and the feedback was universally negative. They regret buying the machine. They call it a failed purchase. I mean, the language that people use, you know, people mocked it. There are people that we talked to that were just frustrated. They described this Dilbert-type dynamic where some executive at the company, you know, kind of got, you know, dazzled by a Berkeley Lights presentation, goes out, buys a machine. You know, the staff that actually has to run the experiments are kind of like, you know, tearing their hair out. And then they have to kind of periodically use it so they don't get in trouble, so the executive can save face and say this $2 million purchase, you know, actually isn't like a complete and total waste. Yeah, very, very credible customers that know what they're doing are saying that this thing is a joke.
Well, and there's one group that really isn't a customer that if this was so revolutionary, they should be part of this massive TAM that they're citing, and that's academia. And that's part of the reason that people aren't using it is it hasn't been accepted by academia.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because it's important to understand the role that academia plays in adoptions of machines like this. So if you look at a company like Illumina, one thing that they did that was really smart, and this was actually brought up by a number of the customers that we interviewed because they wanted to paint the contrast, is that they basically seeded academia with their sequencing product. And people started using it. They started having results with it. They started putting out publications, right? Then there's validation. There's credibility. There's buzz. People talk about it at conferences. And the big pharmaceutical companies start using it. And you can start getting this ecosystem of vendors, of software, and it becomes a virtuous self-fulfilling prophecy. It's a massive red flag. This thing has virtually no usage in academia, right? We went and we did a search on PubMed. There are essentially no publications talking about the machine. You know, you'd want to see somebody who had success coming up with a novel antibody. And there's none of that. And many, many customers that we talked to brought that up. You know, they're like, look, there's just nothing in literature. There's a dearth. Like, how do I even know if this thing is worth my time? Not only that, they're not going to get any academic customers because they can't afford to pay $2 million. So they developed this machine called the Lightning, which is a cheaper version of the Beacon at $750,000. They gave that machine to UCSF. They gave that machine to NIH. And former employees that we talked to said those customers stopped using it a couple months. They just sent it back, right? They just couldn't get any publishable data out of it. Like, it was just too unusable. You know, they tried using it for a couple months with Berkeley Lights essentially operating it for them with extensive handholding and support. And then as soon as they faded, they stopped using it.
Well, and it's extremely difficult to use. I noticed that a number of people actually had to hire new people to specifically run this machine because it isn't quite the off-the-shelf type of product.
You know, I think the best description was one of the customers that we talked to. He said it's sort of like they designed this Lamborghini to kind of drive around the corner to pick up your kid from school. And it breaks in all the time. Like, who knows how to drive it? Who knows how to maintain it and service it? Another recurring theme from one interview after another was that it just takes months and months to learn how to use it. So difficult that staff have better things to do. So they avoid it. And the way that these pharma companies have gotten around that is that they've, you know, hired in some cases like two dedicated full-time equivalents per machine. Right, which adds like whatever it is, you know, $300,000, $500,000, whatever, you know, your loaded cost is per technician. And a former employee who's one of the most knowledgeable users of the product helped develop it indicated that, you know, it can actually take years to learn the ins and outs of the product. The error handling protocol alone is pages and pages and pages. There's so many steps involved in just kind of running a simple assay. So everything is custom. Nothing is off the shelf. It's just overwhelming to people at pretty much every level. Using, learning it is overwhelming. Using it is overwhelming. It just spews data. Apparently, we hear that it just spews thousands of data points, you know, per cell. You kind of look at that like, well, okay, what do you even do with that? So yeah, the lack of usability just compounds all the other problems. You know, like the fact that it's overpriced. Customers or employees, so the pricing needs to drop, you know, by 50, 80, 90%. Those were, you know, the price reduction figures that we got from different people. Competitors sell similar capabilities for 3 to 5% of the cost. $30,000, $50,000, $100,000 companies like 10x Genomics have seller public companies with billions of dollars in market cap that are growing very rapidly have alternative offerings. So, you know, this all explains the question that I laid out, explains the answer to the question I laid out earlier, you know, the elephant in the room. If the TAM is 25 billion, if your product is revolutionary, why have you only placed 92 machines over 5 years, right? That's the question that I think anybody who wants to own the stock has to keep asking themselves, right? Like, that's sort of like the dog that didn't bark.
I mean, notwithstanding that the product might not actually work for what they say it does, but as well, I mean, they're talking about a $25 billion TAM, and it's already trading at pretty high multiples relative to sales, which are dwindling. Like, what is the real TAM, and where are sales at this point in time?
So the real TAM, according to former employees, similar feedback from the customers that we talked to, you know, is maybe, you know, a couple hundred machines. You know, at $2 million per machine, yeah, that's $400 million, you know, $500 million of total addressable market. And it actually makes sense if you look at how many they've sold, right? I mean, the fact that, you know, you have a giant company like Pfizer, right, might have one or two machines, right? It kind of seems to be, it's like kind of one machine for like every 50 or 100 billion in market cap. That's kind of, people find some random low value use for the product, right? So there are a number of ways you can kind of back into that number, but at most it's a couple hundred machines, right? This thing is essentially, I mean, one way I would explain it, it's kind of like a radio telescope, right? Like, you know, you think of cells like, you know, stars in the sky, right? Those are like all the, you know, the thousands and millions of cells that you have in a sample. So this cell, this product, you know, gives you really high resolution at the single cell level. Okay, well, how often do I need to pick out, you know, kind of one star in the sky, you know, for like really deep analysis? Not very often, right? There, actually looked this up on Wikipedia. I think there are about 200 radio telescopes around the world. Not a bad analogy, right? That's kind of like the number of beacon machines you need around the world, right? You need sort of like a couple hundred for occasional one-off, very specialized uses. So the real TAM is a fraction of the market cap. This thing trades at 30 times sales. The real TAM is like, you know, 300, 400 million bucks. Assuming the product even works, you have to make a lot of assumptions to get there. That's over many, many years. There are a lot of warning signs that we see that indicate that sales are already starting to slow. And these are the typical red flags that you see in your peak before things completely collapse. Let me just kind of point out some of those. Number one, product revenue the last 4 quarters is essentially already flat, right? So they have deteriorating quality of revenue, and they don't actually, you know, break it out that tightly in their press releases. So you have to go look at their filings. They have many different types of revenue. They have product revenue, which is actually selling the machine. Within product revenue, they have consumable. Every time you do a run, you have to buy these disposable chips, you have to buy reagents, all that stuff ends up adding up. So you have sales of the machine, you have these consumables. Then there's this new category of revenue that's becoming more and more prevalent, which is collaboration revenue, which is they're just kind of, you know, doing custom work on behalf of customers. And this is supposed to be like an interesting product company. When a product company starts doing custom consulting collaboration type work, that is a huge red flag that things are hitting the wall. Product revenue is already starting to flatten out. Number two, the machine doesn't actually seem to be used that much. So if you look at the install base of machines and you look at the amount of disposables revenue that they break up, it works out to about $40,000-$50,000 per machine. It's actually trended down the last few quarters. Third red flag is they've had this massive spike in distributor revenue. So they had some distributors, we believe, in Asia. They have some sort of distribution deal with Nikon where you actually kind of read the fine print in their filings. Nikon actually has to buy a certain amount of equipment every year as part of the distribution deal. So, but in the last couple of quarters, distributor revenue has just become super normal. I forget the percentage off the top of my head. It's in my deck. But when you see that kind of sudden anomaly, to us, that typically suggests channel stuffing, right? Where you have insiders that are selling a lot of stock, they need the stock to stay high, and they're probably not going to hit the quarter. And the typical trick is, you know, you have some distributor in Europe or Asia, you just kind of stuff a bunch of machines. The other data point that leads us to believe that that may be going on is that you have this sudden spike in receivables, right, in the last couple quarters. So that's a huge warning sign. So the fourth warning sign, deteriorating quality revenue, which I already mentioned. Right, they're starting to plug in all kinds of other revenue in there, which is not product revenue. And the last thing that I think is a huge warning sign that suggests that, you know, the TAM is small, sales are slowing, is they're starting to they have this subscription program, which is a fancy way of saying okay, you don't want to spend $2 million, we'll just kind of rent you the product for a little while. Like if Lamborghini or Ferrari moved to a model where they couldn't sell cars anymore and they have to start renting them to people, I mean, think about what that would mean. There are a lot of things that add up here that lead us to believe that this is a very tightly coiled situation, right? They've been public for about a year. You know, they managed to kind of create enough of a story, you know, create some numbers, you can kind of peek the thing. You know, venture capitalists started selling very early after the IPO, you know, unusually early. So this has all the hallmarks to us of a classic pump and dump.
Yeah, so I want to talk about those holders. You mentioned that they had a prominent VC firm, and you said they've been selling. Who are the other holders? How does this stock trade? I mean, it IPO'd last year, and it peaked up kind of around the time that everything did, sort of in January, and since then it has traded down. Who does own this thing?
The biggest holder is one of the founders, and we didn't really talk about the origin story of this company. This company was founded by a bunch of semiconductor guys who kind of took this discovery, I think, that was made at UC Berkeley, where scientists like, oh, you know, I can kind of move cells around with light. They're like, oh, this is so exciting. Let's go raise some venture capital. Okay, so what do you do with that? You can push a cell around with light. You know, I think people showed decades ago, I believe, that you can actually suspend a droplet of water like in a laser beam. So pushing things around with, like, you know, light is like, you know, it's something fancy. So anyway, so that founder, who a lot of people said the founding team, because of semiconductor backgrounds, don't really know much about biology, which is part of the reason why the product is like this weird kind of Frankenstein mishmash kind of a thing. He's the biggest holder. The second biggest holder is ARK. So, you know, Kathy Wood's firm, I think they own about $250 million, you know, as of the date that we're doing this interview. And then you have what appear to be a number of large mutual funds. Given how difficult it is to understand what this company does, like it took us a fair amount of digging and research at the beginning, I'm highly skeptical that people that own the stock, even in size, would be able to explain to you what the company does. What does the technology do? Why is it different? Why is it innovative? You know, what's the use case and value proposition? So those are the holders. You know, it's been trading really weak recently. I think it's partly just because of the market. I think there's also a fair amount of insider selling that is going on. You know, there was a secondary last year where venture capitalists sold a lot. So it just kind of tells you, you know, even the people that know the company best don't have a lot of confidence in what the future holds.
So Keir, I think we've covered a lot of your thesis here. Before we wrap it up, I'd like to just have you summarize all the major points, because there's so many sort of damning angles to come at this thing.
Yeah. All right. So where do I start? Let's just kind of go to the laundry list, okay, for why we think this is a zero and why we think it's a great short. Number one, it's vastly overvalued at 30 times sales. Number two, the financials are a dumpster fire. Anybody looking at the financials, the amount of money that this thing loses, you know, deteriorating gross margins, accelerating losses, can see that this thing is simply not a going concern. It's just not a viable company unless it's keep raising money from investors. Number three, the TAM is really small, you know, maybe a few hundred million bucks compared to market cap that is several billion dollars. Next, this is a one product company where the product, based on large number of customer interviews, doesn't work, breaks down, doesn't have a value proposition, doesn't give customers without their buying. Next, it's $2 million, which again limits the TAM and makes it 20 times as expensive or more relative to the competition. Next, insider selling. So if you wanted any corroboration about, you know, the findings from our ex-employee interviews, our customer interviews, there you have it. You know, insiders and venture capitalists, you know, seem to think that something is wrong. Next point, there are a lot of emerging warning signs in the last few months. All you have to do is, you know, look at the filings. Product revenue is essentially flat. Distributor revenues and receivables are spiking, which to us typically indicates channel stuffing to try and make a quarter. Deteriorating quality of revenue. The machine is barely used if you just look at their recurring revenue kind of on a per install basis. And then the last point is, let's just use some common sense. If what they're saying is true, why are they only placed 92 machines in 5 years? Right? That's barely 20 machines per year, you know, for a company with a TAM that's simply $25 million. So final point, because, you know, we just kind of keep laundry listing reasons why this thing is a short, is that this is a very high risk space, right? So they claim they're a synthetic biology company. synthetic biology companies blow up all the time. Go look at Zymergen just a few weeks ago. That stock was down like 75% in a day. So there is a long history of synthetic biology companies just abruptly blowing up. I've shorted some in the past successfully, and we think it's just going to be the next one.
All right, Kier, thank you so much for coming back on the Chopping Block. Looking forward to the next one.
Thanks so much, Max.